This is the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
Hey, brothers and sisters, I have an assignment for you. We're looking for 3 Nephite stories. If you've had any encounters with the Holy Trio, then we want to hear about it. It doesn't even have to be your encounter. Maybe it was your great Aunt Petunia's. Maybe it was something that happened to your roommate's sister's cousin's boyfriend. It doesn't matter, just so long as it's a story about the 3 Nephites. You can call it in to us. Our number is 801-906-6722 and leave a voice message of your story, or you can record your own audio and send it to us at mail@mormonexpression.com. Thanks for the stories. Welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. Tonight we're joined by our regular panelist, Jim.
Hello.
And we're going to be interviewing another special guest. Tonight we have Mitch Horowitz. Mitch is a writer and publisher, and he currently works as the editor-in-chief of Tarcher Penguin in New York. He is the recent author of a book that came out September of this year, 2009, Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. Mitch is a frequent writer and speaker on metaphysical themes, and he's appeared all over the place on CBS Sunday Morning, Dateline NBC, The History Channel, and The Montel Williams Show. We don't want to leave that one out. Mitch, welcome to Mormon Expression.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
Well, maybe we can start by just talking a little bit about your book, about Occult America. Why don't you let us know sort of what you're all about there?
Sure. Thank you. My purpose in writing the book was to produce a serious and full-scale history of occult and supernatural religious movements in America. There has been a tradition of esoteric or occult spirituality in our country going well back to colonial times. In a sense, America, from its earliest days, has always been a kind of a laboratory for a religious experiment. And in the early days of the colonies, America very quickly and very surprisingly developed a reputation for a kind of religious liberalism or a religious tolerance. And people who were part of avant-garde or mystical religious movements in Europe and who were experiencing persecution in the 1600s in particular began to trickle over to our shores. And so very, very quickly, the early American public became acclimated to the presence of religious experiments and new religious groups and communities on American soil. They didn't always get along with them. You know, the history is a checkered one, but by and large, new or avant-garde religious movements were able to find a relatively safe harbor in the American colonies. And I should probably define the term occultism or the occult, because I realize that people have sinister associations sometimes with that term, and I don't mean it that way at all, and I don't use it that way. The term occult entered the English language more or less during the Renaissance. It was a catch-all term that was used to describe some of the old pre-Christian religious practices, including divination, prophecy, astrology, spirit conjuring, a whole wide range of things that occupy the religious mind in the pre-Christian world, and that tended to disappear and go around during the Dark Ages. And during the Renaissance, many of these things were the subject of renewed fascination. And for the very first time, they began to be called by the term occult. It comes from Latin, occultus, meaning secret or hidden or obscure. And, you know, in essence, occultism is basically just the belief that there is some kind of invisible or unseen world that exists parallel to our own, and its influences, its powers can be felt upon us, can be felt through us. That's how classical occultism views itself. It has nothing to do, historically speaking, with any kind of black magic or Satan worship. We may get to that a little bit later in our conversation and sort of how those ideas got associated with occultism, but it's really it's a spirituality that stands outside of any one particular church or congregation and that believes in this idea of an invisible world, another dimension. And sometimes it weaves into the mainstream or the historic faiths, but more often than not, it stands aloof from them, which had always made it any kind of spirituality that isn't moored to a particular congregation or doctrine tends to arouse a suspicion. And that's part of the reason why the occult got bound up in the eyes of its critics with some kind of black magic or something. But that's never really been part of the Western tradition. So anyway, you have this supernatural belief system, which goes under many names, and which encompasses practices that range from astrology to prophecy to divination to talking to the dead. And these things have always had a presence in the Western world and specifically on American soil. And I felt it was time that we had a really fully fledged religious history of occult and esoteric spirituality in America, because it's had such a great impact on our religious culture, on our politics, and on the nature of mainstream religion in America today, that to not treat it like a spiritual tradition that can be talked about, analyzed, understood alongside other religious traditions would mean to be blind to a certain aspect of our past and an unseen and very significant influence on some of the religions of our present. So that's really how this book, Occult America, came to be. It was a piece of religious history that I felt hadn't been seriously considered in our country.
Now, you raised some interesting points there. I think one thing that strikes me is that today the occult and the mainstream religions seem a little bit in opposition, at least in the mind of most Americans. But I get the sense that wasn't true with early Americans.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, Americans tend to adopt ideas but discard movements or labels. You know, so you wouldn't find very many Americans walking around today who would describe themselves as occultists, and yet some of the themes and the ideas of occultism really color a lot of our mainstream religions today. And in the distant past, in the 1600s, America was a more open place religiously than we sometimes understand. You know, people were brought up to think of the founding of our nation as having its basis in the Pilgrims and Puritanism and so forth, and that's all true. But there was also an atmosphere of religious experiment, and that was particularly the case by the late 1600s when an Englishman named William Penn, who was a British Quaker and a very wealthy and influential figure in Great Britain, had a vision that in the American colonies there could be a city, a place, where people of different religious backgrounds could all coexist successfully. And he called it Philadelphia, or the City of Brotherly Love. And by 1682, William Penn had gotten a royal charter from the British Crown to found this city of Philadelphia and to fulfill his dream, in effect. And as it happens, his dream worked in the real world. This city of Philadelphia, which really was just a cluster of a few hundred houses around the early 1680s when he founded it, was populated by people of different religious backgrounds, Mennonites, Quakers, different radical or mystical offshoots of the Lutheran Church. A little later on, it started to attract Jews, Catholics, Amish. And remarkably enough, you had people of these different faiths living together successfully in this town of Philadelphia. And word of this actually began to trickle across the Atlantic back to the old world, back to Europe. And Europe at the time, in the mid to late 1680s, was undergoing this kind of spasm of religious persecution. It was kind of the after effects of the 30 Years' War, which was fought in Central Europe in the 16-teens until the late 1640s. The 30 Years' War was basically a conflict that pitted Catholic armies against Protestant armies. There were a lot of different causes, but that's ultimately what it amounted to. It was a very bloody conclusion, in a sense, to the Reformation, and it also represented a big backlash against some of the occult and religious experimentation that had come out of the Renaissance. It really devastated a section of Central Europe around, ranging from the Rhine Valley to Prague, and at one time that had been a place of great religious liberalism. That was a place where a lot of experiments coming out of the Renaissance played out. People were interested in alchemy, astrology, Kabbalah, number symbolism, all these different philosophies, you know, around this area of the Rhine corridor. And that started to come to an abrupt end in the period around the 30 Years' War and the generations immediately following. So you had people who lived in that area who were able to essentially get out of there. And one man in particular, a very dynamic mystical scholar named Johann Kelpius, did just that. And in 1694, he led a band of about 40 pilgrims out of central Germany across the Atlantic and to the city of Philadelphia, where he and his followers settled on the banks of the Wissahickon Creek, just outside town. And they founded a fairly successful mystical colony. They created a 40-foot square log tabernacle. And on the top of it, they placed a telescope that they had brought with them from Europe. And they used it to scan the stars, to make astrological calculations and prophecies and such. Astrology was one of their many, many interests. And the Kelpius commune, it only lasted a few years, but it existed peaceably and it was successful. And again, amazing enough, through trade and sea travel, word went back to Europe that this mystical commune existed outside of Philly, and there were other followers of Kelpius who began to trickle across the Atlantic. Some of them got here, and in the early 1700s, they were very disappointed because they found that Kelpius had died around that time of tuberculosis. But one of his followers, also a very dynamic guy, named Johann Conrad Beisel, he founded another larger mystical colony in Ephrata, Pennsylvania. And people would visit these places. They were small, you know, but people would visit and they'd write about them in diaries and letters and newspapers and such. And even in those very early days, the idea that religious experiments were taking place, could take place on American soil, was something that people, educated folk, began getting comfortable with. And a pattern got set. And if you jump forward a couple of generations, in the 1770s, in the city of Manchester, England, you had a group of radical Quakers. They were called the Shaking Quakers. And they engaged in things that we today would call seances and spirit channeling and speaking in tongues. And they had this very ecstatic form of worship. And they were charged with sorcery and being involved in black magic. And there was a lot of paranoia about them locally. So their spiritual leader, a young woman named Mother Ann Lee, picked up this group of Shaking Quakers, and they sailed across the Atlantic to New York City in 1775. And they began to get called by the name the Shakers. And they scraped together enough money to form a little mystical colony of their own up in the Hudson River Valley of New York, outside the city of Albany, a place that marked kind of the starting point of a piece of geography that we can talk about later, called the Burned Over District, which was just home to a lot of different religious experiments. But the point is, a pattern was getting set. You know, people who were part of persecuted religious movements in Europe, particularly movements of a supernatural bent or some sort of an alternative bent, began to flow to America, and their colonies were successful. There were sometimes acts of mob violence against them. It's not as if everything just went beautifully, but by and large, they were able to practice their religious movements without being subjected to jailing, persecution, arrest, things that they were facing back in Europe. So this pattern really got set. And perhaps the most influential of all these European movements flowed over to America was Freemasonry. And that's a whole other topic in itself. But Masonry was a movement that came above ground in Europe, also again around the time of the 30 Years' War. And it was a secretive movement, and there were probably good reasons at that time for it to be secretive. There were probably concerns over religious persecution that contributed to that secrecy. But Masonry was a movement that was suffused with all kinds of symbols and influences that came out of the occult Renaissance. They believed in a spiritual search that was bigger and older than any one particular religion or doctrine. Renaissance occultists were fascinated with this idea that somewhere in the distant ancient past, there was some kind of primal religion that was older than any of the faiths that came later. That they felt that there was some kind of primal theology that predated the establishment of any of the historic religions. They were fascinated with this idea, and they thought that maybe it lay within the culture of ancient Egypt. So Freemasons were very part of this Renaissance occult concern, this interest, that there was kind of a universal spiritual search that went beyond the borders of any one religion. And they drew very freely upon ancient symbols that today look very arcane to us, like the all-seeing eye, the obelisk, the pyramid, images of skulls, and, you know, things that really harkened back to a distant religious past. And Masons also held to the principle of religious liberty, religious toleration, ecumenism. They too had this ideal that people of different religious faiths could successfully coexist within a single organization or within a single nation. And that seems very mild to us today. But back in the 1600s, 1700s, this was a very radical point of view. And it quickly took flight in the American colonies as Freemasonry traveled to America, often through the movements of British troops. People from all different strata of society became involved in Freemasonry. This included some of the most influential people in early American society, some of the founding fathers, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Paul Revere, John Hancock, but it also included people from a far less privileged strata of society. There was a black-led Freemasonic lodge that was founded outside the city of Boston in 1775. A British garrison gave a charter, a Freemasonic charter, to a local group of freemen of color. And they formed a black-led Masonic lodge that was called African Lodge No. 1. This lodge was later renamed Prince Hall Masonry after the name of its founding Grand Master, a freed black man named Prince Hall. It became the first black-led abolitionist movement in the American colonies, in the New World. So you can find the influence of Masonry, this clandestine brotherhood that drew upon occult symbols, that believed in a spiritual search that in its view predated any of the historic religions. You can find this influence of Masonry throughout the American colonies, both among the founders and again in far less privileged strata of society. So Masonry was very much in harmony with this American ideal that this nation was breaking with a sectarian past, was breaking with the congregations of the old world, and would be a society similar to what William Penn envisioned, a place where the spiritual search was protected in some way, a place where people and faiths could coexist. It left its thumbprint on some of the political attitudes and the founding documents that began to run through the country. So you can see how movements that in Europe had often been considered esoteric or occult began to enter America, began to change the society, began to introduce some of the religious and civic values that today we take for granted.
Mitch, as a someone who's involved, myself being someone who's involved with Freemasonry, the Enlightenment, how much did that did the Enlightenment play in the development of Freemasonry, both in Europe and in America?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. You know, Masonry is one of the few organizations in modern life whose origins are layered over in a kind of mystery. You know, you'll find disagreement among different lodges, among Masonic historians themselves, about the precise starting point and nature of Masonry's origins. I think the earliest reputable references to Freemasonry are probably found in England and Scotland in the mid-1600s. Specifically in the 1640s, you start to find diaries and letters where you encounter the first really veritable references to Masonry, where somebody will write, "I was inducted tonight into a Freemasonic lodge." And you start to see, you know, a vernacular that's unmistakable. You had a lot of different influences that contribute to Masonry. Obviously, you know, you had the stirrings of Enlightenment culture. You had the Reformation, where people were still struggling to find a way to define a Christianity that existed outside the structures of the church. You also had influences from the religious liberalism and some of the occult practices and ideas that had bubbled up during the Renaissance. For example, in the early 1600s, Europe was just enthralled with this rumor that there existed some kind of a secret brotherhood called the Rosicrucians that believed in mystical practices and all kinds of religiously liberal ideas. And around 1614, some anonymously written Rosicrucian manuscripts began to circulate throughout Europe, starting in Germany. And I don't, you know, it's a subject of debate whether a Rosicrucian Brotherhood really existed, but the manuscripts certainly existed. So whether they were produced by some hidden brotherhood or just by a few individuals, whoever's hand was behind them, they were filled with all kinds of arousing ideas. Again, you know, ideas of a radical ecumenism, religious liberty, a belief in some kind of social polity, helping the poor, helping the sick. They foretold a new era in education and understanding. You know, these were themes that sort of became like the central liberal themes of the day, and actually still resonate in America's alternative spiritual culture and in other parts of American life today. So you can find within Freemasonry ideals, symbols, and a vocabulary that seem to be an echo of some of the things that were coming out of the Rosicrucian manuscripts. So all these things, I think, wound together. And I see Masonry as this radical organization that kind of came bursting out of the Reformation. It was maybe one of the most radical thought groups that emerged from the Reformation. You've got these Renaissance occult influences through the Rosicrucian manuscripts. You've got influences coming through the Reformation. You've got early influences coming out of the Enlightenment. One of the people who one of the English figures who made some of the earliest references in his diary to Freemasonry, a British antiquarian named Elias Ashmole. He and a circle of his friends were involved in the founding of the British Royal Academy, which was one of the first great research institutions that was aligned with rationalist scientific and logic principles. So, you know, you have all these influences, I think, finding a home in Freemasonry. And and traveling to America. And I think having an outsized influence in America, because in the late 1600s, early 1700s, the United States, of course, is still this very sparsely settled agrarian society. The city of Philadelphia in the 1690s consisted of about 500 homes. So, you know, there's very little in the American colonies in the way of libraries, museums, schools. So where are people getting their influences from? You know, I mean, they're getting their influences obviously from their religion and from their personal and fraternal affiliations, of which Masonry is one of the most prominent. So, you know, this organization that's home to so many radical ideas, you know, bubbling up in Europe, finds an outsized influence right away in America. So you have all these different channels. You know, the Enlightenment is one channel, and among some of these others. But Masonry seems to be the point of gravity where all these things get wound together.
Mitch, you mentioned earlier sort of a theological breaking with the old churches of Europe, but in America, from what I understand, there was a literal breaking with the churches as the westward expansion pushed the settlers west. They kind of went faster than the churches could keep up with them.
Beautifully put, yeah.
now, how did that influence this, the growth or the continuation of the occult sort of folk magic practices and folk religion?
That's just beautifully put. The people migrated faster than the churches could keep up. That's exactly what happened. And you know, if you look at migration flows in America, that's where you find all the new religions cropping up. Wherever there's a new flow of people, that's where there's religious experimentation. And
that's
that actually brings us
correlation. Yeah, I mean, it's almost like there's a kind of like a do-it-yourself, you know, kind of mentality or
yes.
drive in the human nature to come up with a reinterpretation of what you were steeped in, you know, before you were kind of out there on your own.
That's perfectly put. Yeah, that's exactly what was going on, you know, and this actually brings us back to, I mentioned the city of Albany in the Hudson Valley region of New York State, and how the city of Albany was the easternmost point of a region in central New York State in the early 1800s came to be called the Burned Over District. It was considered burned over with religious passion, with the fires of the spirit. That's how it was sometimes referred to in the press. And it's basically a strip of land that extends from Albany in the east way out to Buffalo in the west. It runs maybe about 350 miles roughly. This narrow, snaking stretch of land, the Burned Over District, actually became a kind of great highway for people who were settling the country in a westward direction. You had a whole flow, after the War of Independence, you had a whole flow of New Englanders passing through the Burned Over District on their way out to Ohio and further points west, sometimes points south, to settle the nation. This portion of upstate New York had been occupied by the Iroquois Nation. And the Iroquois, of course, and the colonial government were obviously at odds. And the Iroquois made a very ill-fated alliance with the British during the War of Independence. And after the war, the colonial government used that as the pretext to push the Iroquois off of its traditional land in central New York State. And this was very, very rich, beautiful, lush farmland. And it still is today. I mean, the place, even with the march of modernity, the place is remarkably preserved as agricultural land. And it's magnificent. Just rolling hills, very rich soil, beautiful lakes. And so the colonial government, or the new government, the new American government, opens up this land in central New York State to expansion, settlement, and so a whole flood of New Englanders are attracted to the Burned Over District. And they, some of them stay, establish farms and such, and some of them, again, they use the place as a great carriage path to head westward. And there was a big broad carriage path running through that part of New York State, and it still exists today. It's called U.S. Route 20. It's a great highway that runs from Boston out to the Oregon coast. It's the longest road in the United States, and back then it was a carriage path, but it was a place where people could flow through. And it also became a place where religious ideas flowed through. There was one historian who called it a psychic highway. It was a great highway for all kinds of experimental religious ideas because, you know, as you were just saying earlier, folks left New England, and the churches couldn't keep up with them. They left behind the congregations, the communities, the churches of their homes, of their childhoods. They were relatively liberal folk. They flowed to this beautiful, rich land that at the time had been depopulated as the Iroquois were pushed off. And they were ready to join new congregations, to listen to new ideas, to form new communities. And they attracted every kind of itinerant minister in the new nation that was seeking some kind of an audience, some kind of a congregation. And that's why that's one of the reasons why it became called the Burned Over District. People used burned over in different ways. There were some people who said it was burned over with religious passion because you had all these itinerant ministers going through there, and people would engage in these really ecstatic forms of worship. There were tent revival meetings and speaking in tongues, and people would kind of dance on fire with the Spirit. There were all these wild reports coming out of the Burned Over District in the early 1800s. And some ministers would use the term in a different way. They say, oh, don't even bother going to upstate New York. That place has been burned over, as if to say, there's no souls there left to convert. Everybody belongs to some sect or movement. Everybody's spoken for up there now. You know, people used it in different ways. But the fact is, the Burned Over District, in the early generations of the 1800s, became the springboard for just about every religious experiment in America. And in fact, it was not only the religious laboratory of America, but it was the religious laboratory of the world, ultimately. This place gave birth to the religions of Mormonism, Seventh-day Adventism, to some extent, to the mental healing movement that started to sweep the country. It was the birthplace of spiritualism, or this business of talking to the dead, holding seances and such. It was the birthplace of the women's rights movement. First Women's Rights Convention was held there in 1848. In some respects, it served to spread movements of abolitionism and temperance throughout America. It was home to America's utopian communities, including the Oneida community, which was a community based on biblical communism that probably was the longest lived and most successful experimental commune in America ever. So the Burned Over District was this incredible laboratory for social and religious ideas. And again, it wasn't just in America alone that these ideas took flight, but I mean, very, very diffuse movements ranging from Mormonism to spiritualism went on to spread not only throughout America, but across the world, and are spreading still from this one very beautiful and relatively isolated piece of land, but it served as a great highway. Folks were flowing down this psychic highway, settling the rest of the country, and religious ideas went with them. And anywhere you know you see the flow of traffic in America, including up to the present day, you'll see new religions cropping up.
I think we also tend to forget, in this modern day of TV and lots of books and radio and everything else, once you left the big cities on the East Coast, you know, you had your family Bible and probably not much else. This was a big
Yes.
form of entertainment. You know, you're working hard on the farm. You'd go to the itinerant preacher. This is one of the few things that was entertaining out there.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was outside of family and farm. It was about the only opportunity for social interaction that people would have, and they took so much. They took their relationships from their religion, their sense of self, their sense of the world, you know. And boy, people, as you said, you know, people would have perhaps the Bible was the only household book they would have, and they really knew the Bible. you know, one of the religions that grew out of the burned over district that I didn't mention was, I made reference to Seventh-day Adventism. Now Seventh-day Adventism was a movement that grew out of the burned over district in the 1830s and 1840s. There was a Freemason and a Baptist minister named William Miller. And Miller did what many of the folks living in the burned over district did, which is he read scripture passionately, fervently, frequently, and he believed that scripture was a literal blueprint to all aspects of life, and that it could be rationally dissected to the point where one could determine the date of Armageddon. And people had different conceptions, of course, what Armageddon meant. It didn't mean an apocalypse to everyone. To some people, it meant the inauguration of an era of great peace. And Miller leaned more in that direction, I think, although sometimes these things were ambiguous. Miller named the dates of apocalypse as occurring in 1844, and he assembled a what eventually became a huge movement around him, and they were known as the Millerites. And of course, Miller's apocalyptic dates came and went, and nothing apparently happened of worldly note. Some people called it the Great Disappointment, but it was interesting. You know, there was a habit of thought in the burned over district where if a religious prophecy was made and the advent didn't come, people didn't fall apart. You know, they sort of brushed themselves off. They took stock of the movement and they either moved into another movement or they rearranged the celestial interpretation of what had been going on, which is what happened in the Millerite movement to some extent, and they formed another movement.
That reminds me of, I learned this in school in one of my psychology classes, and there was a UFO cult last century that was studied by a group of psychologists, and they had a prophecy that a UFO would come and take them away. And what they found was that the faith, after the prophecy came and went and nothing happened, their faith became stronger in that. And I think we see that happen in almost any prophetic organization based on prophetic, end times.
Yes. And, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of these groups in America had what we today would call apocalyptic beliefs, but they weren't based strictly and solely on that. You know, even the Kelpiest movement that located, that picked itself up from central Germany and came to America in 1694, in a sense, they were apocalypsts, and they believed that the 30 Years' War was sort of the harbinger of worse things to come, and they felt that going to the New World was, in effect, fleeing to safer ground. But they had certain dates to which they pegged an apocalypse, and it didn't happen. And again, the movement didn't fall apart. You know, there was a certain fluidity. There wasn't always, these things weren't always held with this kind of coarse extremism. You know, these people were poring over scripture and they were trying desperately to make sense of the world. They were trying to relate scripture to their daily lives. And, you know, there was a little bit of a hit and miss mentality. And you saw it in the Kelpiest movement. You saw it among the Millerites. There were all these stories that have circulated in certain history books and in legend that the followers of William Miller engaged in all these kind of weird acts shortly before Miller's end time dates, that they engaged in free love and they threw their money to the wind and they neglected their farms and their businesses, and they put on these white ascension robes and they gathered locally up on hills, you know, waiting for the end times to dawn. And there's, you know, the Miller's move was very heavily written about in newspapers. It was a favorite of the press. Press often mocked it. And really none of that stuff can be found in period newspapers of the day. These were tall tales. This was local legend that got repeated enough so that it became considered factual. But in fact, the habit of thought that you saw in the burned over district and that I think came to color American religious attitudes is people could engage in fantastical beliefs and theorizing and ideas and still hold firm to the necessities and the realities of daily existence. It was a kind of, they weren't fanatics, they were idealists in a way. They were radical idealists and they were practical idealists. They didn't throw life to the winds when they engaged in this prophesizing or speculation over apocalyptic dates. They were passionately religious. They were trying to make sense of the world. And you know, as you're pointing out, if they found that, gee, the dates were wrong, sometimes they would, some people would drift away and others would just kind of rework the celestial mechanics. And Miller's movement eventually morphed into the religion of Seventh-day Adventism and today counts itself as one of the mainstream Christian congregations in America. So, you know, this was typical of life in the burned over district. You know, you had people experimenting with just all kinds of things. And, it was a place of great passion and the ideas just traveled up and down this psychic highway, you know, throughout that region and throughout the nation.
We've talked largely about two themes so far, the events and, thoughts that led up to the, you know, the burned over district and what was there. And we've talked about Masonry. Interestingly enough, at the time of Joseph Smith, from what I understand, there was strong tension during the early part of the 19th century between the Freemasons and the Greater American Society.
Yeah, yeah. People often ask, why do many Americans have a paranoid or conspiratorial attitudes towards Masonry today? I mean, I'm not sure how widespread that attitude is, but it certainly exists online. I think that those attitudes are very misplaced, but some of them might be the legacy of an episode that occurred in the Burned Over District in the 1820s, where there was a disgruntled Freemason in the town of Batavia, New York. His name was William Morgan, and he was supposedly preparing for publication a manuscript that was intended to reveal some secrets of Freemasonry. And Morgan found himself subject to some real persecution. He was arrested on specious charges. The print shop that held his manuscript was burned down. He obviously was experiencing some kind of harassment. And he eventually disappeared and was never seen again. And he was presumed kidnapped and murdered at the hands of Freemasonic zealots. There was a legal investigation afterwards that focused on Freemasonry, but that seemed to just go nowhere. It didn't come to any decisive conclusions or convictions. And the attitude took hold, first in the Burned Over District and then throughout the nation, that this guy had been kidnapped and murdered, and that Freemasonry was protecting its own and was wielding undue influence in the courts and in the legal system. And at the time, there was also a general kind of populist anger about corruption among the privileged, and this populist anger wound up getting channeled at Freemasonry. And so there was a great wave of anti-Masonic attitude in the country that began in the Burned Over District and then again spread throughout the whole society. And there were anti-Masonic newspapers that sprang up and anti-Masonic political parties, anti-Masonic candidates got sent to state legislatures. And there was all this passion that the influence of Masonry had to be routed out of our public life. Now, this tended to pass within a few years. It didn't build. It kind of dissipated. And Masonry still retained the membership of some very influential political and civic business figures. But it never again had the same level of prestige in American life. After that, there was always a little bit of a shadow over Freemasonry in American life. And although that episode of anti-Masonry has largely been forgotten in our history, the attitude that it left behind has lingered. And that probably informs some of the anti-Masonic feeling that one will still encounter from time to time in certain circles in America and certainly online. I mean, people just have these bizarrely exaggerated ideas about Masonry as some hidden hand behind our finance and politics. And they're looking in entirely the wrong place, you know, and sometimes people will jokingly say to me, you know, come on, admit it. Doesn't Freemasonry run the world? And I jokingly respond back, you know, I wish, because its founding values, at least as they played out in the United States, were very positive. Today,
yeah,
Freemasonry...
It's almost as silly as saying the Rotary Club runs the world, you know. It's
right.
Yeah.
Which would be approximately fine with me, you know. But, I don't think Masonry today, you know, it's a charitable organization. It's a fraternal organization. It runs a wonderful network of children's hospitals under the auspices of the Shriners Hospitals. And, understanding Masonry as it exists today, it's sometimes really difficult to come to terms with these paranoid attitudes that people have. But some of it may be a very, very distant echo of the anti-Masonic wave that swept out of the burned-over district in the 1820s.
Well, and it's fascinating how that plays out in Mormonism. Of course, the Book of Mormon, written in 1830, many see an anti-Masonic theme running through the book. And of course, 10 years later, the Mormons in Nauvoo had fully embraced Masonry, incorporating it into the temple ceremonies. And in the most ironic twist, Joseph Smith eventually married Morgan's widow there we were talking about.
Isn't it something? Yeah. I mean, when you come across that in history, you say to yourself, you know, there's such a so many remarkable twists and turns of human events in American religious history that it's almost hard to believe. You know, it seems, based on what we understand, the Smith family and the Morgans, although they didn't live very far apart, were probably completely unacquainted with one another in upstate New York. But after Joseph Smith began to bring his movement out west, William Morgan's widow, Lucinda, remarries. She and her new husband follow Smith's movement out west. And eventually, they connect, Lucinda and Smith. She becomes one of his spiritual wives. And he, in the late 1830s, early 1840s, is coming profoundly under the influence of Freemasonry, deeply interested in it, is charters a lodge, as you mentioned, in Nauvoo, Illinois, seems to feel that some of the rites and rituals of Freemasonry may be debased rituals that are a distant echo of some of the priestly rites that were practiced in connection with the Hebrew tabernacle, and seems to feel that if some of these rites and rituals and practices can be revived, reconsidered, joined to his new religion, there may be a way of trying to reestablish some thread of connection back to the rites, the Hebrew tabernacle. And, you know, the early 1840s at Nauvoo must have been this terrifically exciting time religiously and theologically. You know, it seems that there was just so much that was going on in terms of Smith's worldview and the ideas that he was taking in. You know, some of this is, of course, speculative. You know, I mean, some historians have speculated that with his colleague Alexander Niebuhr, French Jewish convert to Mormonism, Smith may have been studying aspects of Kabbalah. You know, he appeared to be studying Hebrew with Niebuhr. He was deeply interested in Freemasonry. You know, there were so many innovations and different thought currents going on. But it is fascinating how some of the rites and symbols of Masonry have today become a part of the foundation of LDS.
Yeah, and the fascinating thing is a lot of Mormons really don't know about that connection, you know.
Yes.
And on top of that, and kind of switch gears, we've talked about Joseph Smith and his relation to Freemasonry. Can you talk a little bit about Joseph Smith and his family's relation to folk magic?
Sure. You know, the Smith family, like many New England families, was attracted to the burned over district because it was open to settlement. It had rich arable farmland, and there were so many farming families in New England who couldn't wait to get out of New England because it had this rocky soil, rooty, rocky soil. It was hard to grow things there. And boy, when you enter the burned over district, I mean, it must have seemed like heaven on earth because the farmland there is just extraordinary, really rich and beautiful, except for the parts that the Shakers settled because the Shakers didn't have very much money. So the land that the Shakers bought up by Albany, which is somewhat preserved today, is still the rocky, rooty soil that you find in New England. You can't even imagine how they survived there. It's kind of miraculous in a way. But anyway, Smith's family migrated from New England into central New York State for the same reasons that everybody else did. And they seemed, based on some surviving records and diaries and articles, they seemed to be very much in line with some of the religious experimentation and the folklore that was that abounded in the burned over district. You know, one of the beliefs that was very deeply formed in the foundations of the burned over district was that land had once been occupied by an ancient tribe, a tribe that was older even than the oldest Native American tribes. And this was a very widespread view in New York society. In fact, New York's governor, DeWitt Clinton, spoke on this very theme in the early 1800s in front of the New York Historical Society. And he very forthrightly said, there are burial mounds and artifacts that have been found in the upstate New York area that suggest the existence there at one time of a civilization much more advanced than the current civilization of Native Americans. And people were very aroused and excited by these ideas. And there was a lot of treasure hunting that went on in the area of the burned over district because there were Indian burial mounds and there were also rumors that pirates had buried some of their treasure and booty up there at that time. So people were interested in treasure hunting. They were interested in this folklore, this mythology that an ancient tribe had once occupied the area. They were involved in a whole wide range of folkloric and magical practices that included dowsing, astrology, divination. Joseph seemed to be involved with what was called peepstoning, where you could take a translucent stone, place it into your hat, and use it to gain the power of second sight. According to some historians, Joseph was, for a period of time, considered a local psychic or clairvoyant and sometimes used to rent out his services to local area treasure hunters.
Was that the act of treasure digging and peepstoning, was that a reputable task or a reputable, I guess, something to do in a local community? What was the perception of the individuals who performed that?
I think it was considered a little bit on the fringes, you know. I mean, it was funny. People were fascinated with these things. I mean, when DeWitt Clinton spoke about the presence of burial mounds and artifacts, he was reflecting a very broad popular interest in these things. And, you know, there was a widespread fascination with the question of whether buried treasure or remains of this ancient tribe that people spoke of could be found within the burned over district. I think that when you got onto the subject of treasure hunting and peepstoning, it was on the fringes. You know, they're probably, you know, the burned over district, it's funny. I mean, people had all kinds of magical beliefs and folkloric practices, but there was a Christian moral outlook still ruled the day, and probably treasure hunting was considered something that the finest young men and women did not engage in. You know, that's the impression I get from the records that we have. And you know, it's interesting. The Smith family seems to have had certainly some interest in some of the magical and folkloric practices that had traveled from the old world over to the new world. And specifically, and this is a matter of controversy in some circles, and I don't mean to suggest that what I'm presenting is by any means the last word on the subject. But Joseph seemed to have worn around his neck a silver amulet with astrological symbols or sigils carved in it.
Specifically, the Jupiter talisman.
Yes, the Jupiter talisman, specifically pertaining to Jupiter, which had a prominent place in his astrological birth chart. And I've seen photographs of the Jupiter talisman, and it's very intriguing because the symbols of Jupiter that appear on Joseph's talisman they directly reflect astrological symbols of Jupiter that appeared in a Renaissance occult work called Occulta Philosophia, produced by a Renaissance scholar named Cornelius Agrippa. Agrippa was the first person who used the term occult or occulta in a spiritual sense. He was the one who introduced ultimately the word occult into our modern vernacular.
What, and Agrippa, that book, what, if any, relation does that have with a similar book called The Key of the Solomon the King? Have you heard of that before?
I have, although there's a closer relationship that Agrippa's volume has to a book that I think would have been much more likely to have been in the Smith household and found in the households of other burned over district families. And that's a book that was produced in Great Britain in 1801 called The Magus by a British occultist named Francis Barrett. Barrett is sort of infamous because he was a book pirate, and he lifted whole section of Cornelius Agrippa's Occulta Philosophia and just repurposed them, to use a 21st century term, in his book, The Magus. And The Magus was published in 1801. Agrippa's book almost certainly would have been just completely unknown to the vast majority of the English-speaking public, even those who had interest in magical or occult philosophies. But Barrett's book, The Magus, was fairly widespread. And sure enough, if you look in Barrett's book, you'll find the very same astrological symbols of Jupiter that appeared in Agrippa. So the likelihood is that as a young man, Joseph or his neighbors or friends had a copy of Barrett's book, The Magus. That was by far the most widespread of these books. And if they wanted to make use of astrological symbols or sigils, that was the source. So you find that Joseph had this amulet with these astrological symbols that have a lineage that go all the way back to Cornelius Agrippa up through this 1801 astrological occultic book, The Magus. And you know, this to a degree was the world that he lived in. These were the influences that ran through the burned over district. You had a folklore, you had magical ideas and practices. In surviving oral records, his mother spoke of the family's interest in the faculty of abrach. Abrach is just this fascinating, interesting word that occurs in Genesis. Its meaning is not clear. It's not known. It's not fully understood. But it seemed to be some kind of an incantation or a blessing that people would shout out in front of the patriarch Joseph's chariot as he rode through. If that's the context in which it's found in Scripture. It also seems to be the root of a term, abraxas, that Gnostic Christians, that is to say early Christians who were sort of like on the threshold between the Christian worldview and the pagan worldview, they were very hard to classify. They had a series of deities, one of whom they would call abraxas. It was also the root, it seems to be the root of the magic word abracadabra. So, anyway, the Smith family matriarch Lucy in oral record has spoken of the family's interest in the faculty of abrach. And to me, you know, this all bespeaks what in some respects was a very normal life in the Burned Over District. Obviously, not everyone in the Burned Over District had magical interests. You had a wide range of interests. Some folks were very mainline Methodists or Lutherans and wanted no part of this stuff at all. And some folks, like the Smith family, certainly considered themselves Christian, attended different Christian congregations and churches, but also some of the occultic and esoteric religious ideas that ran through the Burned Over District were part of their lives too. And you find again and again, this is a trait that's particular to America. If you were to run into somebody in the 19th century who was engaged in some sort of spiritualist or occult practice and said to them, "What's your religion?" they would probably say, "I'm a Methodist," you know, or, you know, something like that. People didn't see a dividing line between Christian worship and occult experiment. They just didn't. They didn't see themselves as standing outside of Christendom because they were interested in folk magic.
It's almost as if the occult or the spiritual nature of these practices seem to be almost a kind of a mechanical way of interacting with what they perceived as, you know, a second layer of spirits that encompass the world. But, you know, it's this mechanical way of interacting with the unseen.
Yeah. And that's the core occult belief, that there exists this invisible world, this unseen world, and it can be tapped for prophecy, for information, for help. Its influences can be felt. Its influences can be harnessed. And you know, that's the basic occult worldview, that there's some kind of invisible world out there. And participating in that, engaging in that, certainly on American soil, didn't require that anybody leave behind the congregation of their family or the congregation of their youth. And, you know, that was life in the Burned Over District. That in some ways was the culture and the atmosphere that Joseph grew up in.
Yeah, to use the software development term, I guess it's more of an open source religion.
Exactly. Know? Yes. Yeah. That's the American style. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
All right, Mitch. The hour has flown by. It's been a fascinating discussion. I think we've laid a good kind of framework for what Joseph Smith was born into and at least the roots of the influence on the religion. Maybe sometime we'll have to have you back and talk a little bit more about the continuing influence that this stuff had on the Mormon religion.
I'd be delighted. I've really enjoyed this time talking with you all.
Now, you can see Mitch Horowitz's webpage at MitchHorowitz.com. We'll have a link on our webpage to that, and you've got a lot of great information there. And, of course, the book Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation is available, and I highly recommend it. Mitch, thanks again.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Not to gush, but I really enjoyed the book.
It
was fascinating.
I really appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Great. As always, you can navigate over to our webpage where the discussion continues at MormonExpression.com. You can call and leave a message at 801-906-6722, or you can send us a message at mail@MormonExpression.com.